was inspired by Barry Mason's equation for change, and I kind of adapted it slightly for organizational equation for change. And I think it connects closely for me with the diversity working party groups. And this equation would be key participants. And I think that's where the DWP's groups, you know, key participants, key people that, and that is people who've got a real understanding of the problem, but also key people who are the decision makers need to get together. These are the key participants plus dialogue. So it's not communication by email or just, you know, it's real dialogue, a two-way meaning-making process going on, plus time, plus a shared understanding, I'd say, of the problem, also vision. So it's one or the other. You know, we need to have a shared understanding of the problem, but we also need to know where we're trying to get to, have some sort of an idea of a vision. For me, then, all of that added together equals steps towards meaningful change. So that's the process, and for me, that's the organisational equation for change. And for me, I think the DWPs and that are the embodiment, just structurally way they were being set up, that are kind of living that equation really of how do we make meaningful change within APT, but also out there.
Welcome to The Systemic Way. In today's episode, Cesar and I are going to be talking to Parveen Kaur and Amy Urry about the DWPs, the Diversity Working Parties, which have been set up by AFT. The Diversity Working Parties are subgroups within AFT, which are really there for people, members of AFT, to get together and to encourage conversations around different areas in diversity. I believe my understanding at the moment is that there are some that are set up around race, gender, religion. There are other ones that I could mention, but I know they're also open to people setting up groups that aren't there already. And I guess the purpose of today's conversation really is to introduce people to the DWP and to raise awareness about it and to let people get in touch should they wish to be involved in those conversations. Cesar, is there anything you'd like to add about the conversation that we had with Amy and Parveen?
Yeah, I think it was a really insightful discussion into the work that's taking place with lots of different groups coming together to have some really important conversations collectively. And this kind of being useful for us as therapists to bring into our thinking around the work and bringing it out into our work with families and individuals that we work with, but also bringing it into the system and bringing it into the organisation of AFT and reshaping the organisation to really, really kind of authentically thinking about some of these really important and crucial aspects of life and thinking about how we can make changes from within through all these different lenses that we all bring. So I really enjoyed the conversation, and there's some real nuggets to take away from both what Amy and Parveen shared with us and their ideas of how they do this stuff and how they have conversations around diversity. So I think it's a really useful resource, and I encourage people to look up the Diversity Working Party and to join and to take part in essentially what is a real opportunity to make change.
Okay, welcome to The Systemic Way. Thank you, Amy and Parveen, for joining us today. Really, really excited to have this conversation with you. How are you both doing?
Very good. And I'm excited to talk about this particular project that Parveen and I have been involved in and wondering what will come forth from our conversations.
Yes, we're good, thank you. And just like Amy said, looking forward to talking a bit more about the Diversity Working Party and introducing, you know, some of the groups and looking forward to the series and hearing more about some of them. I know some of them will be invited along to talk a little bit more in depth about the group. So, but this is kind of, we're starting to tell the story a bit about the how and the why came about.
And thanks, Parveen. And I suppose before we get into the how and the why, and you're right, we're here today to talk about within the organisation of AFT, the Diversity Working Group. But before we get there, it'd be really lovely to have an introduction to each of you.
Shall I go first?
Yeah.
Okay, so my name's Amy Urry, and I've been involved in the family therapy world since the 1970s, and have always been very attracted to family therapy. And in the context of this podcast, one of the things that really drew me to family therapy was that it really did seem to take into account social context and social contextual inequalities, and that seemed to me a very important thing in a psychotherapeutic modality, and more recently, as a family therapist working within the Association for Family Therapy, as the acting executive director, as well as being involved in clinical work and supervisory work and teaching work, you know, the width of the systemic approach feels really, really important to hold onto. You know, we don't forget individuals, and we don't forget bigger social contextual issues and context and everything that goes in between.
And welcome back, Amy. We should say that as well. So thanks for joining us again. So
my pleasure.
Oh, a little bit about me then, Parveen. So I'm Parveen Kaur. Started out, my parents are both migrants from India. They came over in the late 60s, early 70s. So I've always grown up in the Midlands. So born and bred there, and there's bilingual, and straddling both of those cultures growing up. So for me, there's always something about family, culture, community, and also living with a family that were migrants from India. There was that real strong Indian and Sikh culture at home, and then going to British schools. And the area that we lived in wasn't that diverse, actually. So I often found myself, whether it was at school or college, being one of the very few people who were a minority. So there was always there was a culture that I tried to fit in out there. And then there was a different world back at home. And it was like living two different lives. It always felt like growing up, two different lives, different languages, different cultures, different way of dressing, even, you know, when I used to come home from school, put Indian clothes on back at home. So there was that growing up. And I was fascinated growing up about couples, you know, relationships. So I trained as a couple therapist with Relate. And again, adapting a lot of the teaching and stuff that we learned about, but adapting it to how does that connect with Indian culture and how would that connect with an Asian couple or for someone like me? And through that, got really interested in family therapy. My supervisor was also a family therapist and at Relate. So I'm fascinated with systemic thinking. And often when I do couple work, I think, actually, wouldn't it be great if I was trained as a family therapist, I can then say, bring the kids in and we can carry on the work. So, yeah, so that's when I got into family therapy and trained as a family therapist. And then stayed there, carried on. Supervision training, systemic leadership training, just carried on. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Parveen. Could you both tell us a bit about your connection to the Association of Family Therapy? What's the connection now in kind of beginning to thinking about this diversity working party? I'm interested in one, where that came from, but your connection at this kind of to the organization.
So I've been an AFT member for many years, and became a member before it was, you know, possible to register with the United Kingdom Council for psychotherapy. Before that all happened, before we developed the professional pathway and the registration of members and accreditation of courses. So many years I've been a member. More recently, I have been involved with various committees and joined the board, and then from the board took on the acting executive director role for what at first seemed to be 3 months before the permanent CEO would come in. That went on for about 18 months, actually. And I did that. Now we have Hannah Szyberski in post as the CEO. And so during that time, I was involved with a number of projects, and probably the most important in one of the most important areas, and for me the most important area, I think, within AFT was to think about how we attend to diversity issues. So being in that role, having the interest from the members, having some discontent from members too, really gave me space to think and to work with others about how we could attend to inequalities, diversities, and how we could hear from members and do something about flattening hierarchies, hearing voices, encouraging participation.
Thank you, Amy. And how about you, Parveen?
So I started out actually. So my connection to AFT is as well as an AFT member, but vice chair of the registration committee. So I started off as registration committee member, looking at applications for registrations and CPD reviews, and vice chair of the registration committee at the moment. And the connection with the DWP was then, how do we use some of those lenses when we're looking at registrations? Who's registering with us? Who's not? CPD opportunities. It just really made us think that we really using that lens in that committee, working with each other, but also all the applications that come through and tending to that. I'm also a current member of the CRED committee. So again, using the same lens there, but flipping it slightly differently. So rather than looking at new registrants coming in, you know, who's coming in, what does the diversity of the registration people look, people that are registering with us at family therapies, new ones looking like. At the CRED committee, it's an opportunity for accrediting the different training courses across the UK, and also again using that lens of diversity, whether that's reading lists, access to the training courses, the curriculum, workshops that are available, staff that are delivering the training. So if you're a trainee, you know, you can see the diversity within the training context of people delivering the training as well as experiencing the content. So we're really thinking a lot about that in the CRED committee as well at AFT. And then my role with as a diversity working party coordinator. So that's my then there's that role as well. But before I got that role, I started off in the race and ethnicity group. So I started off in that group. That was an area I was drawn to. And a lot of some of the things that we spoke about was with the groups, it's if you've got lived experience and you've got a particular interest, you can make a contribution. So for me, I started out that before I got the was in the coordinator role, but now it's mainly in the coordinator role, connecting with the other groups.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I suppose I was just wondering, would now be the right time and an opportunity maybe to explain what the Diversity Working Party group is?
So maybe a little bit more about the history. What the board were very aware of, and the committees, that the diversity was not being attended to enough, although affecting everyone a lot. And in different contexts. So what was quite a painful time in the association was to absolutely realize that we needed to look within the organization, that for the Association for Family Therapy and Systemic Practice, that, you know, that we were not attending to diversity enough, that we, you know, our representation, our policies, needed to shift. We were also aware that we had work to do thinking about who are our members, and how do people become excluded, and what do we do about that? So to really look at whether we're doing a good enough job, and to widen access to membership, once people are members, to really think about how people experience that membership, whether they feel they're a full member of the association, that they truly are represented, given their contexts. And so, of course, equally important to think about our clients, to think about access to services, and that would link into what happens for trainees in training, and as they prepare to work with clients. And I guess the murder of George Floyd was a hugely important time in the UK, and of course elsewhere, but in the UK a hugely important time when a lot of painful acknowledgement happened, and it was various things that were happening within AFT that prior to his murder, but certainly came into an energetic force that we were an organization and we were a profession that really needed to look at race, the terribleness of racism, the perniciousness and the invisibility of it, as well as to be thinking about other inequalities. So it was a big dilemma in the beginning about how do we do this, and how do we give space so we are able to attend a lot to race, anti-racism, but we're not neglecting other marginalized, oppressed groups. So the beginnings of the ideas about the diversity working party structure came from that, the need for there to be more than one group, race being, of course, very important, and needing space, not wanting to dilute the groups by putting it all together. We had a diversity diversity, equality and inclusion committee. We still do. But one of the challenges there is that there's a lot of work being done at a lot of different areas. So, you know, that we felt it made sense to have a diversity working party that was made up of different groups that could come together, so that we, you know, we can think about the all-important intersectionality too. So I suppose, you know, something prior to the current structure of the diversity working party groups is that we had a number of meetings, open meetings, where we invited people to come along and share their experiences and contribute with their ideas. And that happened for a number of months on a monthly basis before the current structure was developed. It was the end of 2021 that we began to think about how we would go ahead and create diversity working party groups.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Amy. It's really interesting to locate it within the kind of the historical context of the wider society, but also within the context of AFT itself and our profession. So thank you for that.
I guess just to add to that, you know, social context being all that, this was the time of COVID, and we many of us were becoming so aware of that, although, you know, COVID was affecting everyone, it was affecting people in very different ways. And, you know, that was very much about the inequalities in the world. And so, you know, and that the class issues and the racist issues of religion, disability, you know, there was so much that was really coming into focus. So, you know, that it was you know, it was an important time of realization.
Mm-hmm. It really put a magnifying glass on a lot of those things and brought it to the mass attention and the immediate feedback of death rates. You know, I mean, what other kind of stats really ever matter when we're thinking about the impact of death? But going down a very morbid route with that. Parveen, I'm wondering if you could perhaps tell us what the different groups are.
Yeah. So with the six at the moment, we've got the age group, the diversity working party group, class and income, race and ethnicity, the ableism group, the faith and spirituality group, and gender and sexuality. And I think often there is that phase of when there's something that you're looking at, there's something that you're not. It's not forgetting the intersectionality between the graces. And we started out with five groups, and age is the one, you know, the newest of them. And again, we're looking at it as spectrum across. So we think they're still forming. It's still new. That's not to say more groups won't emerge. There's a lot of joint working between the groups. And we're finding that just as we, you know, have been around just for over a year, some are still forming, but some are still finding things. Actually, they've grown quite big, and they're having areas, streams that they're going to focus on between them, whether it's research, whether it's external facing in terms of supporting members who are employees, consulting to employers around some of these lenses. That's another word term we're using interchangeably when we're talking about the diversity working party groups. We're saying we're lenses, and we'll be using these lenses internally in AFT to look at, you know, reflexively at ourselves, but also these are lenses outward facing, that where we're supporting our membership, our diverse membership, whatever journey and stage they're at, in terms of their training or even thinking about training. And there's something around that, the social context. So where can systemic lenses and thinking at a wider level, community level, employer level, organisational level, how these lenses could also be useful. So that's a little bit about the different groups that we've got, but also the fact that we're still emerging and growing and evolving.
What has been quite a fascinating process is to set something up that's not absolutely scripted, you know, so that it was very important that those people stepping forward to be part of each group created their own parameters. And as you were saying, Parveen, you know, deciding what it was important to focus on, knowing that there would be overlap, but there might be differences. And it felt really important that it came from the voices and the lived experience of the members. And we've also wanted to, you know, have some parameters and expectations. The board were really wanting these groups to influence what happened within AFT and linked activities in AFT. So, you know, they wanted outcomes. They wanted each group to feed into the board recommendations. So, you know, one of the things that we have worked about a lot is, you know, how do we facilitate this from the board, from AFT, so that people are clear, people are respected, people aren't exploited, people are held. And at this point, actually, it's becoming clearer that there needs to be more guidelines from the organisation. So Hannah, our CEO at the moment, is busy working on terms of reference that can be standardised. And we're busy working about what the expectations of the board are and what do the board expect of each of the groups. So that can become much more understood. And although, I mean, in some ways, I think a frustrating process, that it had to be this process, because if we had scripted it from the beginning, it wouldn't have been, you know, co-authored and agreed. I guess, yeah, you know, the other thing that feels as though it's been really, really important is to know that in each group, conversations can be hot, can be difficult, that not everybody is going to agree. So how to make groups safe and not be, you know, a working group that's got an outcome of production has been a really important piece to attend to, how each group works about that. And again, as you were saying, Parveen, you know, this really is work in progress. That some groups attracted a membership very quickly. There are groups, the class and income group, and the age and ages and group, which is the new one. They struggle more to attract people to join. So, you know, being able to operate with groups being at a different stage of development has been something to bear in mind.
For me, I think there's something about the energies of the groups and the energy at the time. So if we, you know, touching back what you said, Amy, at the time of the forming of these groups was the COVID pandemic, you know, disparities that we were seeing out there in the community, people, what they're experiencing. It like I said, it really did put diversity out there and more people were talking about it. And all organizations were saying, how can we do more? And how we can do more than talking and take action. And they were wanting to move from just talking and thinking about something to meaningful change. So for me, the diversity working parties, the authenticity, the organicness of them getting together and sharing, why have I joined this group? What's brought me here? Why have I got together? What do I feel passionate about? What are my experiences from this lens being? And for me, it's closely tied to meaningful change and real change and wanting to see change. So there's a lot of energy in saying we've got an opportunity to make a difference. We're going to join these groups and, you know, use these lenses to really make a difference to the field of family therapy, systemic therapy, the members and participants of our and systemic thinkers. So for me, it closely linked with that. And I've got in front of me here, it's something, and it connects organisationally as well. I was inspired by Barry Mason's Equation for Change, and I kind of adapted it slightly for Organisational Equation for Change. And I think it connects closely for me with the Diversity Working Party groups. And this equation would be key participants. And I think that's where the DWP's groups, you know, key participants, key people, that, and that is people who've got a real understanding of the problem, but also key people who are the decision makers, need to get together. These are the key participants, plus dialogue. So it's not communication by email or just, you know, it's real dialogue, a two-way meaning-making process going on, plus time, plus a shared understanding, I'll say, of the problem, also vision. So it's one or the other. You know, we need to have a shared understanding of the problem, but we also need to know where we're trying to get to, have some sort of an idea of a vision. For me, then, all of that added together equals steps towards meaningful change. So that's the process. And for me, that's the organizational equation for change. And for me, I think the DWPs and that are the embodiment, just structurally way they were being set up, that are kind of living that equation, really, of how do we make meaningful change within APT, but also out there.
I absolutely love that, Parveen. I've written that down. That's really brought it to life for me, actually. And I'm interested in the complexities of putting each component of that equation for change in place, and how challenging and difficult each one is. And maybe we can get there, but my mind is flowing with lots of questions, actually. I want to try and catch some of the important things you've both said, if that's okay. I was pleased that you spoke about intersectionality, because when I kind of first looked at the structure of the groups, I mean, it covers such a vast area of kind of diversity, right? And it's fantastic. But I did wonder, by separating these things out, how much are we kind of, are we losing the opportunity to look at how these kind of things interact and interplay with each other? So I'm glad to hear about the co-working. And then hearing Amy talking about the kind of the some of the goals within this, about being quite outcome orientated and or output, and to produce something, you know, that's useful for therapists, for the field, and how those two things marry up was in my mind. Can it create some competitiveness between the groups, which that might then create some, I don't know, separation? And I wonder if that has been a bit of a challenge that you thought about or have come across.
From my experience, it hasn't, actually. This is where I think the systemicness of it really comes out. They're working apart and together. They're doing the both end. So all of the groups meet collectively in their own groups. A lot of energy, a lot of work, a lot of thinking is going on. And then we have a multi-group meeting bi-monthly, and where all the groups get together, facilitators of all the groups get together. And we get to, and again, it's not like your other meetings where there's an agenda and it's structured. There's a few standing. The way we want to do it is it's collective, it's collaborative. Let's hear how you're all getting on, what's going on, what's happening. And hearing, it's so energizing hearing what everybody's doing in their groups, the sharing of the ideas. For me, that's the thing. There hasn't been the element of competitiveness. If anything, there's been the element of awe of what the energy and the passion that's going into each of the groups. And when we hear that, for me, that just ignites people even more to the passion. That's what I see when the groups get together. And the most recent meeting that we had, the groups were like, we so much enjoy getting together, seeing the overlaps between us. There might be things that we work on collectively together, or a piece of research we might do together. We don't get the opportunity to collectively to get together outside of this meeting. So one of the ideas we came up, because we said, well, look, we're still forming, you know, there's no fixed rule of what this is going to look like. And given that we've met a few times, we're starting to see how we need to use this space and how we need it. So our multi-group meetings every other month is going to be without the coordinator or Amy there. They just, because they're already scheduled in. So we've made this, the space is there. The groups are just going to get together themselves. So they still have their own meetings where they're apart, but then they have a space where they, like a base where they connect together as well. Mm. So for me, there's something about, yeah, they're doing the both and. Mm-hmm.
It really feels that this development is saying, yeah, you know, it's established now that the ownership of the groups by the group members, and then, you know, the linking meetings, that people are owning it. Yes, you know, your role of as coordinator is really important. My role has been as liaison between the diversity work party groups and the rest of AFT and especially the board. But that now, you know, that this is happening and perfectly appropriately happening without us, seems a good place to have arrived at.
Thanks, Amy. I suppose if I could add on, I was really struck, I think, at the beginning as well, Pavin, like when you said that you may still be with the race and ethnicity group. And then I was like, oh, so what drew her to come and be part of the DWP? But I think you've expanded on that beautifully, and you've sort of explained, and I guess what I've got from that is the intersection, there's a coming together of all of those groups and a sharing of experience and knowledge that's different, and in some way it made me think, because I was thinking, and Cesar and I, when we were preparing for this, we were saying, oh yeah, you know, and George Floyd happened, like lots of institutions, there were these groups set up all over the place, you know, what happens with these groups. But I think you've been explaining actually how this model is different in some ways, because it's inviting groups that might exist in isolated positions to work together. And I think you mentioned, and that's a very exciting to me, it's one of the things that's really excited me in listening, and it sounds like, you know, I think you mentioned that there's research that they might be, you know, joining across different groups. I was curious about how it's fed back to AFT and what it might mean for change for AFT and other sort of actions that might be coming out of it.
And that is so important. And I think, you know, that the whole way of doing things being about dialogue has been key and core. Now, you know, within the association, of course, family therapists do like to talk to one another, and they do like to talk, don't we? But when it's more the business of the association, that, you know, the committees will link with the board and each other in quite a business-like way. And what we found quite soon was that there wasn't a great sense of satisfaction if there was just reporting into the board. We really wanted more dialogue. And, you know, it wasn't just about response in email. It really was about dialogue. So at first, Parveen and I, we were going along to board meetings and reporting back. There were reports that would go from each of the written reports that would go from the groups to the board, but it was falling flat. You know, it didn't have that life and energy, and was at worst rather demoralizing, actually, with not the response and life that was deserved. So what has happened is that one of our board members Karen, who is particularly interested in inequalities and diversities, now will attend the general meetings, the multi-group meetings, to hear and to speak and to be in conversation. And Hannah, Szyborski, as the CEO, also comes along to the meetings. And so that richness is really important. Not to discount, though, the importance of having a business-like agreement. So with the terms of reference, you know, they're being... they're needing to be articulated and lived experience of what happens when there is communication and what's expected. And it's all very well, you know, that the groups have all worked really hard to come up with proposals, suggestions. Well, at all positive if they come up with that and then there isn't a response from the board and the relevant committees and affiliated groups within AFF. So getting that more business-like side clear, as well as having the dialogues, feels really important. I think, you know, another really important thing would be not to overburden each of the groups with requests from the rest of AFT. So that's been a balance, I would say, too, that you know, to really appreciate the contribution, but not to inundate with invitations to present at conferences and become part of organizing committees and feed into all of the committees. And that, you know, that's quite challenging.
I think what you've talked about there, Amy, for me really connects with how it's developed. Those were some of the challenges, but also how we're getting through and overcoming some of those challenges. When you talked about the dialogue, so, you know, there's been that structural shift of what organizations can get into, those structural patterns of a business and an agenda and who reports to who and hierarchy. And what we've done with the diversity working parties, the way we're working, is it's gone from the groups meet, a report is written and a reporting back. You know, there's something disconnected about that and kind of can feel in a relational organization that works with relationship, disconnecting, and it can feel that way. It kind of brings that disconnectedness. Mm. So that's evolved and changed too. There isn't that hierarchy. There's no middle person or somebody else that you have to go through to talk to each other. We can directly email each other. We can directly attend each other's meetings and connect with each other. So there's been that flip, you know, of rather than the groups and somebody reporting in, the board are joining the meetings. And for me, that's that part of that, you know, equation for change. The key participants are getting together. Yeah. They're in the same room, they're at the same table, and they're having a conversation rather than these conversations are happening in separate places and messengers are going and attending the meetings. For me, that's, you know, showing a structural shift in how we go about doing these things. So that's, for me, a step towards meaningful change in the process itself.
Mm. I can't take my eyes off this kind of your reworking of the Masons change equation. And I'm trying to look at the different parts. And I'm really interested in what some of the challenges have been in terms of bringing the people of the key participants, the people to join the different groups, to maintain those conversations, to be, I know you said some of those discussions can be, the dialogues can be really challenging and difficult. So how some of the challenges in keeping people and keeping the energy for people, and I'm hearing some of it is this kind of the connection with actual change and meaningful connections with the board that has helped towards that. So I just wanted to ask you what you think about has been some of your main challenges within that and what some of the successes are also.
I think some of the challenges have been, you know, that everybody's really, just in terms of the post-pandemic, busy. A lot of the members work full-time, families, And working in organizations where there was the big resignation once that work-life balance was felt, you know, over the lockdown. So they're working even harder because there's workforce difficulties as people aren't applying for the jobs. So in the context of all of that, you've got that there's something around the energy levels and that being able to have the time to commit regularly and consistently to this process. The other thing is also platforms of, you know, our website, which we know is being designed. There's changes happening to get there. So we're kind of, the groups are formed before, from a technology and digital point of view, those other aspects are formed, but they're catching up. And we're starting to get to that place where we're meeting together, where that we're more visible. Because again, groups like this in most organizations become something can become easily in other organizations out there, tokenistic things that the organization is saying, we're tending to diversity. And they're just left on their own in a corner somewhere getting on with it. And what we're doing here is working on how are we right at the center of everything. We're not on the side, we're in the center, we're integrated, we're woven throughout as a lens. You're almost like the heartbeat of the organization. But so there's something around, so those have been some of the challenges, but those conversations and dialogue are happening of being more visible on the website. The groups are getting little 10-minute videos together, introducing themselves, a little conversation that will go on the website. So all of these things are starting to happen, but those are some of the challenges. And some of it has been time, you know, getting together, recruiting more people amongst the number of other challenges that they have from their jobs and all the other things out there. And for me, the other big challenge is trust, you know. Like I said, it comes back to when there's lots of other organizations that might be good on the surface of digitally showing diversity, but it's not lived behind. There's an outer dialogue or missions or values that are communicated that aren't lived inside. So there's sometimes that inside-outside difference. Something's shown there, but on the inside, it's not the inner dialogue of the organization. And for us with that, I think that's what we're doing different. The inner dialogue is we want change. There's energy towards wanting change. And how can we structurally make so many, what needs to change? So we do look different to other organizations that are out there that are doing diversity. So that is visibility, but also be part of the key players that make the decisions. And so for me, that's something that I'm noticing we are doing. But there has been challenges along the way, but we're getting there. But for me, that was it, the trust side of things. So those people who kind of lost, some people gave up, you know, we don't think change is going to happen. We're tired, we've got no energy, we're burnt out, we don't think it's going to happen. And then you've got some people saying, I don't want to give up hope. I'm really passionate about this and I don't want to give up hope. And I want to still believe change can happen. And the first step towards that might be, how can I be the change I want to see? So how can I start doing rather than just talking about change, but doing change? And that's where, you know, some of the things I was thinking about was conversations that I was having with people was, how can we change microaggressions to micro changes? What is it? How can we use these lenses in the everyday things that we do to make that micro change that what would have been a microaggression? Mm-hmm. And just make those changes so we can say it's one small step, but each of these small steps will, you know, become progression and steps towards that meaningful change. So there is a lot of those micro changes happening in the everyday, day-to-day things that we can do on autopilot, where we're saying, oh, let me use these lenses to do that and look at it again.
I think that's so important. And I think that in the last 18 months, that there's been difficult periods for the Diversity Working Party groups, and, you know, within AFT, that there has been there's been conflict, there's been disappointment, there's been a real need to to really hold the mirror up on the micro and macro aggressions that exist within AFT and elsewhere. But to do that and hold on to hope and progress, and the most difficult times that I've experienced is when it's felt so failing, that AFT is failing, the world is failing, yeah, these things are so big and so painful. Mm-hmm. So painful. And really, really painful to know that you're part of the problem and not the solution. It's one of the worst things for a therapist, maybe, isn't it? But really taking that on board and acknowledging it, absolutely acknowledging this is wrong. This is wrong in terms of maybe I personally have been behaving, as well as the different contexts I'm residing in and outside of me. Acknowledging that, but still holding on to an optimism about change. And people will hold up the mirrors in different ways. I think that's been so important within the organization. Like with any important change, I think you're always going to have some people who will be the angriest on behalf of themselves and on behalf of others. And they have an important place. That they have an important place. It's not always about nice, polite conversation. But if everybody's doing that, we're not then getting a mass of coming together to work collaboratively, being able to support, being able to collapse a bit, and then being able to move on. So, I think it's been such an essential part for people to bring themselves in all of their ragged emotional states, actually, and the organization to have its own ragged emotional state at times.
And for me, that connects a lot with safety. If we're thinking about challenges, how do we all emotionally and psychologically feel safe in these dialogues and conversations and this change and trust? Because there is that a lot of emotion, hurt, upset, anger, all of those emotions involved, especially if you have been marginalized and got lived experiences of marginalization and oppression. So for me, there is something around, when we're working towards change, embodying just the way we, our process to think about safety, inclusion safety. It immediately thinks about those four stages of psychological safety, inclusion safety, learner safety. Are we all learning from this? Is there safety to learn? Is there safety to make mistakes? And not hold, not punish the other person for making a mistake and further oppressing somebody for making a mistake. Mm-hmm. They're enabling them to feel safe to make a mistake so they can learn from it. And contributor safety, feeling safe to contribute whatever it is that you're thinking. And for that to be heard. Mm. And then challenger safety, being able to challenge without feeling that you're going to be persecuted for that challenge. So for me, all of those things are important. And how do we hold those principles and values in mind through the process of this organizationally, internally, and externally?
Yeah, those are really important areas, I think, Praveen, and as you were talking about that, thinking about in every human relationship, it's really important to have rupture and repair, isn't it? And not to think we're failing if we have rupture, but really know that we can repair. And sometimes the repair isn't all done by the same people at the same time. having to have individual ways of repairing as well as in different dialogues and different parts of the organization or context. And I think, you can't just have a terms of reference about this, that we will expect rupture and we will repair. You can't define that, can you? You absolutely have to work it out, work it out and show. Show you from Parveen, from how you've been, from how I've been, from how, more importantly, the group members have been, that this can happen. This can happen.
I suppose I was thinking, as I was listening to you both talking then, about as a discipline, as a systemic discipline, this group has come out of, you put it in the context of, of the time that we were living through COVID, through George Floyd. And what does it say? Like, have we asked ourselves these questions enough in the past? And what does it say about us as a discipline with this coming out and forming at this time and moving forward and how we might think about change?
I guess we should also add, it was a time of austerity. It was a time of Brexit. Within the UK, many other things were,
of course,
were happening. The particular the particular ways that we were being governed, that politics. There were many things happening during this. This period. So to answer your question, what does this say? What does it say about the systemic world?
For me, I was thinking, even before saying about the systemic world, there's what I'm from the groups, what I'm noticing they're doing is they have been thinking about this. The difference is, I think a lot of the systemic world has been thinking about this, but then it comes back to the, what does it look like? What does the doing look like? There's been the talking about it, there's been the thinking about it, but what does the doing of it look like? And I think that's where we're at the moment, in that these groups are doing the doing. And if I put my hat on as a trainer, one of the race and ethnicity groups have done a series of role play videos recordings. Because what's come out of this is how, as if you've got a client or a family where there might be a racist parent with their child who's probably having an interracial relationship that comes to you as a family therapist, and depending on your race as a family therapist, how would you work with that? And a lot of the up-and-coming family therapists that we're training might ask about these. How can I be a culturally competent therapist? What are the approach method techniques that I would use when working in that context? So our race and ethnicity groups have done a series of role plays that are experienced family therapists and lived experiences. And they've done a series of role play recordings and videos of exactly how you might work and address some of those things as a systemic therapist. And they are looking at different training programs, trialing them out. In the delivery of their systemic training, and getting feedback of how these videos are being used, how are trainees experiencing them. So for me, there's something around, we're already starting to see some of that work and how it's going to influence our systemic world moving forwards, but also currently training the future family therapist, but also our seasoned family therapist. So, actually, it's something that I didn't do when I was learning, but in terms of those resources, but I thought about it. I want to refresh myself. I want to reconnect with those ideas. So being able to have resources like this available through these lenses, I think, there's something around it's a real resource for the systemic world and systemic therapists. And I think the more we can have, whether it's for trainers, whether it's for trainees, lecturers and family therapists, whether you're in private practice or not. For me, I think this is a real resource for the systemic world at the moment. And there's some resources that have been around for a while, and it's revisiting them again and putting them in one place. Mm-hmm. There's something about often people have these ideas and think about them, but they think the who, what, where do I go for that? And I think that's where the diversity working party groups have become the who, what, where. When you've got some of those thinkings going on out there, you can go to. And you think, oh, that's where I'll probably go onto the app website, or if I'm looking for that and I'm really connecting with that, or I need that resource or that support. So for me, the diversity working parties become the who, what, where can I go to when I'm feeling this or feeling stuck in some of these areas.
In kind of following on from Julie's question, actually, it's making me think about, as a systemic field, this being a reaction to kind of a need for more third order thinking, critical awareness within all organizations and all walks of life, but psychotherapy in particular and systemic family therapy having a particular set of skills, maybe, you know, or a particular curiosity and interest around this type of thinking and including it in our understanding of the world and people's experiences within it. And when I'm thinking about kind of third order thinking and critical awareness, I'm thinking about the different areas of creating a space for people to come together and talk about this stuff and to have create different understandings, but also to help challenge status quo and bring about meaningful change. But also to create inclusivity and equality in access and employment within the field. And there's some of the ideas that I'm kind of picking up from what some of the goals are for these groups. But I'm also hearing this, and I don't know if my terminology is correct here, so I'd be interested to hear what you both say on this, about this shift more towards a fourth order, you know, the kind of the social activism and social justice and this kind of need to, think about this stuff, talk about this stuff and bring it to our critical awareness, but then to operationalize it and actually do something about it and for something physical and actual to come out of it. That's how I'm imagining where we're at as a field and this group kind of embodying that a bit. Say that again, Poppy, sorry.
It's about, you know, is defining the responsibilities of a systemic psychotherapist, isn't it? I don't think there would be a family psychotherapist, systemic practitioner who would disagree with the notion that social context impacts on emotional, psychological well-being and relational health. You know, it's so clear it does. That families don't make up how they are. They don't create how they are. And, you know, that any intimate relationship is defined by the social context around that, because our work as therapists is quite often in clinical rooms. You know, that all important bit about how do you keep alive that idea and live that idea, you know, so that you're bringing into the therapy room that awareness and somehow not having a split between, you know, a political awareness, if you like, and a clinical activity. Yeah. And that feels a really, really important piece of development, continuing development. And it certainly was there in the early days of family therapy. It wasn't thought about, but now it seems to me that it is time to think about it more, and to think about, you know, not only what happens in therapy rooms, you know, what happens in organizations, employment, training courses, et cetera, et cetera.
And that brings me on to my wish list, Amy. And this is what I think about that vision, you know, that fourth order, my wish list, my dream, you know, our dream. And it is, there's something around, I would love to be able to put on the TV, and if there's been something on the news, whether it's like a disaster or event or all the kind of things that you think of, but a systemic psychotherapist sharing their viewpoint, or has been somebody that's called to say, what are you, you know, the effects. For me, that's been missing out there. You know, there's other disciplines or other people that might be sought to share their views or their perspective on this. And for me, what's been missing is the people who've got the expertise on relationships and families. Because families, whatever makeup they look like, are impacted by everything that goes on out there. So for me, there is something around that vision of being able to, you know, have a media presence in key political, social contexts out there where you've got systemic thinkers, systemic therapists, you know, having that space or that platform to share their thinking and perspectives on, you know, the impact on families with what's going on. So whether it's the economic crisis at the moment, the rise of the cost of living, you know, systemic psychotherapists are saying this is the impact it's having on families and young people, or in, you know, people who are employed or people who are wanting to train. So for me, I would love to be able to see that as to get there as a profession, to really have those spaces, actually, to be able to have those spaces and platform.
Fantastic image. I've got an idea of, on the back of that, of having a systemic therapist as one of the resident writers for like EastEnders. It aims to capture the, you know, the family dynamics of our times. But yeah, why not?
Exactly. And I think this is where I think even our training, so we've got foundation, we've got the qualifying course, but I think, yeah, moving beyond that, you know, systemic consultancy, move out wider there. Because if we're looking at that organization equation for change for organization, we need systemic consultants and systemic leaders and systemic thinkers. Having influences in those contexts and make a difference to the ordinary people, you know, the frontline people who work there. So for me, there's something around, you know, after accredited systemic leadership, systemic consultancy trainings. I really see that, because if we really want to make a difference, we've got to be, like I said again, be at those tables or have a seat at those tables and have a dialogue or a space in those forums. So for me, there's something definitely putting systemic coaching out there, systemic leadership, systemic consultancy out there. For me, there's a real space for that, actually, because there's an appetite out there. But I think, you know, but organizationally, we could meet that.
I think it's so true that you know, to know that the work of systemic practitioners and systemic psychotherapists is so much more than in clinical therapy rooms, always has been, and really is, isn't it? You know, there's so much more that we can contribute in our own organizations and outside of them.
I feel I have to say, including Coronation Street and Brookside, in that image. And I want to continue with this London bias discourse.
I think the Archers too. It's not just TV. You've got to think about radio as well.
Is that still going, is it, Amy, your Archers?
Oh, yes.
Is it? Yeah. Lovely. And look, we always try to end with a few questions about looking to the future. And I know you've put that beautiful kind of call to arms really out there. But I did have a question on the back of what you mentioned earlier about the less attended groups. So the age and then the class and income. And I wonder what you both think, what kind of meaning you're making. I know you said it being new, particularly for the age. But I wonder if these are less attended because maybe there's less diverse representation in those particular graces. I don't know. I just wonder what you both think about why those two groups are less attended at the moment.
It's a good question. And I think that any time there's an energy that goes towards something, isn't there? And certainly race and ethnicity, and faith and religion, were very dominating in people's minds, and rightly so. Sexuality and gender, also, you know, so those three groups probably have been attracting people because of the energy that was around. It's very interesting, the class and income group, isn't it? Because I guess we naturally are less diverse as an organization, as family therapists, that, you know, my own roots are working class, but to become a family therapist, to have followed my career, you know, I've joined the ranks of the middle class. And so, you know, although I would have an interest to sort of really have lived experience of low income, working class experience that might not be found within the membership of AFT so easily. So it might be that we're wanting to attract in other people with lived experience that could help us with that. The age one, you know, that we haven't got any children joined our groups, have we? You know, so we can't be representative of children's voices, but maybe we should think about that. Children, teenagers, young, you know, some young adults, but they're not that young as adults. Some of us as adults are getting much older, but we're, you know, that we're not representing the very old age groups. So, you know, although knowing that's really important, how we attract people in, how we attend to that is really, really important.
And often I've heard John say, you know, when we think about the social graces, often age can be the least challenged grace. And there can be so many nuances, jokes made about age, and so many people do experience marginalization. So if you're looking younger and you're trying to have a presence, a professional presence or certain contexts, that can, you know, impact your voice being heard. And if you're looking older, that can also make you visible or invisible in certain contexts and have less of a presence. So, but often it is the grace that, you know, you hear about that can be the least challenged. Of most people can make jokes about it and it's laughed off, and it's... So it was a really interesting, you know, thinking about it in that way. But we do know that we're looking at age. In the last meeting that we've had, the group was talking about it, saying, but what do I think about when I think about age? You know, am I being drawn to a particular age? And I'm just looking at it from that point of view and thinking about that. But, and again, that's when we started looking at across the spectrum of, you know, age chronologically, but also age in your development, where you're at, and what does that mean at your stage of career, or whether you're listened to, you have a presence or not. So we started to look at it at a more wider, from a wider lens, and I think that the hope is, you know, when that group also comes and talks to you a bit more, you get to hear a bit more about that, and I think that might again make it more visible, people hearing a little bit more about it and think, actually, yeah, I think I can resonate with that, I connect with that. Because often, you know, if I'm thinking about age, that is a social grace for those things that I've talked about, where people can think, oh, I'm trying to make space to be heard, but I'm not. So that there is that something of, am I part of that or not? And I think maybe hearing a little bit more about it, when the listeners out there hear a bit more about it and the wider lens of we're looking at it for, people will have a connection to that and think, well, yeah, how does age impact me? Me being listened to, me being visible or invisible, and having a presence.
I think the differently abled is changed its names a few times, hasn't it?
Ableism now, yeah.
Yeah, I was at a conference the other day, actually, and a speaker was talking about diverse ability, which I thought was really, really a good way to speak about it. You know, that group has a huge range about, you know, physical disability, illness, sometimes linked with aging, sometimes not. And that, you know, that can become invisible, and people can become invisible when the access isn't there. And how we attract people in, and we have articles in the publication from the Association for Family Therapy that each of the groups are writing, putting out the word, you know, please come join. Because although they've been going for a while, they're all open for people to come and join, members of AFT, and you know, maybe other people who are interested in finding out more and linking in.
And some people might not want to join a group, but might And this is one of the other things that's emerging from the groups. They might not have the time, the space, or the commitment for the group, but they might have a need to access the group or a consultation from the group. Mm. The groups are already starting to think that way. They're saying, actually, we've got a lot of work underway. Some of them, we're doing research or we're doing these sorts of things. We're forming, we're finding ourselves. And there might be some people that might be visitors to the group or have consultations with the group. So there's that side of things as well, or getting to know a bit more about it. When I did the introduction to the groups in the Context magazine, up until only a month ago, as people came across it, I got emails, a flurry of emails saying, I read that little piece and I really want to join this group. Can I join? So I think definitely context helped, and having that platform in every edition is helping recruit more people to some of these groups. So that's something that we're continuing to work on.
Thanks, both of you, actually, because I was thinking, well, of course, we've all got a relationship to any of those groups, although we might, you know, and so is there the part of me was thinking, yeah, well, obviously age, I am of an age, I've been certain ages, so of course you can be part of any of these groups, you've all got something to learn, to give. And I guess I was wondering, you know, you mentioned context as a place for and I know that there's been some articles, and that's a way for people to find out and to join the groups. Are there other ways where people can find out more, or if they are interested, if they do suddenly think, yeah, I want to join a class and income group, how would they go about it?
At the moment, that's work in progress on our website.
Okay.
So there's a huge digitalization process going on within ACT. People are emailing me at the moment. I said, I'll be that buffer for the groups. Send me an email and I'll put you in contact with the group facilitators and when the meetings are. But we're in the process of, we've all put information forward, and like I was saying, 10-minute recordings and videos, which will be used on the ACT website. So when people go on the ACT website, we're visible there. People click on that link and can go. So those are the conversations that are happening at the moment. So the website will, moving forwards, the website will be a good place to know, read a bit about the groups, hear a bit about the groups, and find resources from each of the groups. They're thinking of already having a resources tab and link and page there, whether it's role play videos, whether it's reading, you know, all sorts of things. So at the moment, it is, before we got there, is people can send me an email, whichever group that you're interested in, I can put you in touch with that group. You can connect or link in with a meeting and meet the group, yeah.
I'm thinking people listening to this podcast won't necessarily know the email addresses, but maybe the best thing to do would be to go to the Association for Family Therapy website, and there are some general email addresses there that can be used, and emails will go through to ourselves and to the to be directed to the groups.
And we can put some of those in of the bio for this.
Yeah. That would be great. That would be great.
I've got a final question, if you've got time for it. Because it's been really useful thinking about how people within ACT and can connect to the different groups. And that's fantastic. I'm thinking about it from an organizational perspective. And I'm really in the kind of the idea of the domains of aesthetics here, and thinking about yourselves, what advice might you give for other organizations that are trying to produce something like a diversity working party within their own organizations, and what you might give them as a bit of a starting point or something to think about of how to begin to create something within different organizations from your learning of where you're at in the process so far?
But for me, one of the pieces of advice would be, don't be fearful of, you know, exclusivity. And that's not from an exclusion point of view, but exclusivity of, it's okay to have certain groups meeting where only those members have got an interest in that group. So say for me, if it was race and I'm in that group, don't be fearful of exclusivity. Sometimes exclusive spaces are needed to feel safe enough to have certain kinds of conversations, but do the both and like we're doing. It's okay to have exclusivity and inclusivity at the same time. We can be apart, have safe conversations, and then we can come together and collectively and make that meaningful change. So for me, this, because I think some of the mistakes that other organizations make is, you know, we heard that when we heard Black Lives Matter, it says all lives matter. You know, we heard that. So, and I think, how do we do the both and? Of course, all lives matter. So how can we have exclusive spaces where certain conversations can take place, but also inclusive spaces as well, where everybody gets together? And for me, there's something about the both and for other organizations that are trying to do that. And the other key thing is, you know, getting outside of those structural barriers of hierarchy and those dominant discourses of actually it goes there, then it goes there, and then it comes through to me. You know, I'm in that space. It matters to me. So it comes back to that key participant bit. Does it matter if you're the CEO, you're a board member, or you're this? It's okay to be in that space. You know, humanizing. There's something about humanizing that process. You know, not the hierarchy, but more of a heterarchy, and going to those spaces. So for me, those would be the recommendations of don't be fearful of exclusive spaces. And we can intend to exclusivity and inclusivity, but there's something about presence and actually action as well, not just the talking, the action to keep that momentum going. It's not something that we've done once and the box is ticked and it's gone. So that's the really key thing. If you're really wanting in your organization the people to trust this is genuine change and it's going to come, it's got to be a way of being. So these spaces, these conversations, is the organization saying, this is how we are being. We're not doing diversity. We are being diverse. So for me, that's what it is.
Absolutely. So well said. I think with that, my learning has been, and my advice would be, you know, it's going to be messy and has to be messy. It's going to be uncomfortable, has to be uncomfortable. And that's a sign of, you know, keep on going, don't give up. And that, you know, that actually people coming together is the key. You know, the more people that can come together and be heard with their voices, the better. So, you know, reaching out to those people whose voices have not been heard, I think is a really, really key piece, because the same old people having the same old conversations are going to less easily move on.
Lovely. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
It's been really great. We really look forward to the series, and we look forward to engaging with the different groups and really thinking about the common threads that kind of are bringing the groups together, and really get into critical discussions about their lenses and how they apply to the work we do. So look, thank you so much for kicking us off, and for the wonderful work that you're both doing in the diversity work.
I would say we're facilitating. The work we're facilitating, facilitating less. The thanks goes to, you know, the thanks goes to others that have stepped forward to be in these groups, continue to join, continue to do the work.
Yeah, thank you for having us.